What really happened the night of November 13th, 1974 in the quaint village of Amityville, New York? Facts show that a young man took the lives of his six family members before surrendering to the police. What drove him to commit such a heinous crime? Was he the only one involved? Was there something darker at play than just a demented human will to kill? Today, the Amityville Murders.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Around 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday, November 13th, 1974, 23-year-old Ronald DeFeo entered Henry's Bar in Amityville, Long Island, New York, and declared, "You've got to help me. I think my mother and father are shot." DeFeo and a small group of people went to 112 Ocean Avenue, which was located near the bar, and found that DeFeo's parents were dead inside the house. One of the group, DeFeo's friend, Joe Yeswit, made an emergency call to the Suffolk County Police, who searched the house and found that six members of the same family were dead in their beds. The victims were Ronald Jr.'s parents, Ronald DeFeo Sr. and Luis DeFeo, and his four siblings, Dawn, Allison, Mark, and John Matthew. All of the victims had been shot with a .35 caliber lever-action Marlin .3 36C rifle around 3 o'clock in the morning of that day. The DeFeo's parents had both been shot twice, while the children had all been killed with single shots. Physical evidence suggests that Luis DeFeo and her daughter Allison were both awake at the time of the deaths. According to Suffolk County Police, the victims were all found lying face down in bed. The DeFeo family had occupied 112 Ocean Avenue since purchasing it in 1965. The six victims were later buried in nearby St. Charles Cemetery in Farmingdale. Ronald DeFeo Jr., also known as Butch, was the eldest son of the family and its lone surviving member. He was taken to the local police station for his own protection. After suggesting to police officers at the scene of the crime to the killings had been carried out by a mob hitman, Louis Fellini. However, an interview at the station soon exposed serious inconsistencies in his versions of the events. The following day, he confessed to carrying out the killings himself, and Fellini, the alleged hitman, had an alibi proving he was out of state at the time of the killings. DeFeo told detectives, "Once I started, I couldn't stop. It went so fast." He admitted that he had taken a bath and redressed and detailed where he had discarded crucial evidence such as bloodstained clothes and the Marlin rifle and cartridge before going to work as usual. So this is a story that and a tragedy that has always very much interested me. What interested me initially was, of course, the Amityville horror and everything that happened with that. And we will touch on that in this episode as well. But we're digging back to the beginning, back to the tragedy, back to all of the trauma that happened on that property. We're not just picking up with what George and Kathy Lutz experienced. Quite a story. How well-versed are you in the tragedy aspect of this, the murders prior to the Amityville horror? Carol Hughes joining us today.
Hello. You know, I read the book, but the book and the movie, like the original movie, but they talked more about the haunted house, and here's what happened.
Yeah.
So I've never really dove into what really happened. It's always been not a side note, but it's not been the main story.
Sure.
You know, it's kind of like, here's makes you think the reason all of these things are happening is because those people were murdered.
Yeah.
And but it's also a story I've always been really fascinated by. Mm-hmm. And they, what if they've made like 5 movies?
Yeah, I don't even know
and
how many.
As they went on, they got really bad.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I watched one about a year ago. It might have been 3, or it was like some weird random one, and it was just one of the worst movies I've ever seen.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Like the original one's actually pretty good.
The original wasn't bad, and they did a remake of it around 2004 or so,
probably. And that one,
it was good.
Was as good as the original one was just scarier to me. And then the second, that remake one, mm-hmm. it was more gory and stuff. And sometimes it I was. Think that what really scares you is what you don't see.
It was. And I thought it was a well done horror movie. But as far as its accuracy to the book or to the actual accounts that they gave, I believe George Lutz at the time made the statement because somebody asked him, how accurate is this version? He's like, well, we lived in Amityville and we had a dog.
Oh,
and that's where the
people
similarities
actually
end.
Have done quite a bit of interviewing people involved with it. And mm-hmm. like you actually know quite a bit about this story.
I have. And it's been an interesting journey of trying to talk to people involved with the Amityville Horror. I was going to interview George I think he died in 2004. I don't have the date of it in front of me, but it was around that time window. And I've been communicating with him online. And this was just for my radio show. I was so excited because I've always been so interested in it. And then he passed away. So we never got to have that conversation. But I didn't give up. And years later, I've communicated with one of the sons online. We've always talked about doing an interview. We've never had a date that worked. So we'll see if that ever happens. The most interesting interview I've ever done on the case was with Laura DiDio, who was the reporter that went in and investigated the haunting with the Warrens. And George was somewhat a part of it, but she's one of the original people who reported on the story as it happens, the Amityville Horror Story case as we know it, a lot of it, not the book version, but the reported version from the media is from her. And it was really fascinating to dig into that conversation. And it's a two-hour interview on another podcast we have called The Grave Talks, and that interview came out last year, and it was just so fascinating to hear how she went through the house and everything, all these accounts that you know if you know the story, but hearing it from her mouth. And quite honestly, one of the most interesting parts of that conversation, after we hung up after talking for 2 straight hours on the record with a recorder, was that hour we talked off the record. And I can't talk about it, but there's so many interesting details that people do not know about with that story. And I'm not trying to be elusive and I'm not going to share, but it's like, holy shit, I wish we could say that. I wish we could talk about that, but there's still
people. And now all I'm thinking about is what did she say?
I'll tell you off the air, but it's like, wow, there's more to the story. And it's not more to the story in the aspect of it's made up or anything like that. I believe this happened to these people, the haunting as well. So it's not anything like that. It actually digs a little deeper into that angle. And I guess that's really as deep as I can go. But interesting conversation. That's on our other show. But let's dig more into this story and the murders that occurred at 112 Ocean Avenue. DeFeo's trial began on October 14, 1975. He and his defense lawyer, William Weber, mounted an affirmative defense of insanity with DeFeo, claiming that he killed his family in self-defense because he heard their voices plotting against him. The insanity plea was supported by the psychiatrist for the defense, Daniel Schwartz. The psychiatrist for the prosecution, Dr. Harold Zolin, maintained that although DeFeo was a user of heroin and LSD, he had an antisocial personality disorder and was aware of his actions at the time of the crime. On November 21, 1975, DeFeo was found guilty on 6 counts of second-degree murder. On December 4, 1975, Judge Thomas Stark sentenced DeFeo to 6 concurrent sentences of 25 years to life. DeFeo is currently held at the Sullivan Correctional Facility in the town of Fallsburg, New York, and all of his appeals and requests from the parole board to date have been denied. All six of the victims were found face down in their beds with no signs of struggle. The police investigation concluded that the rifle had not been fitted with a sound suppressor and found no evidence of sedatives having been administered, and instantly thought, leading to speculation that someone in the house should have been awakened by the noise of the gunshots. Police officers and the medical examiner who attended to the scene were initially puzzled by the speed and scale of the killings and considered the possibility of more than one person having been responsible for the crime. Neighbors did not report hearing any gunshots being fired, and those who were awake at the time of the murder simply heard the family's sheepdog Shaggy barking. DeFeo had a volatile relationship with his father, but the motive for the killings remains unclear. He asked police what he had to do in order to collect on his father's life insurance, which prompted the prosecution to suggest at trial that his motive was to collect on the life insurance policies of his parents. Since his conviction, DeFeo has given several varying accounts of how the killings were carried out. In a 1986 interview for Newsday, DeFeo claimed his sister Dawn killed their father, and then their distraught mother killed all of the siblings before he killed his mother. He stated that he took the blame because he was afraid to say anything negative about his mother to her father, Michael, and his father's uncle out of fear that they would kill him. His father's uncle was Pete DeFeo, someone in the Genovese crime family. In this interview, DeFeo also asserted he was married at the time of the murders to a woman named Geraldine Gates, with whom he was living in New Jersey, and that his mother phoned to ask him to return to Amityville to break up a fight between Dawn and their father. Subsequently, he drove to Amityville with Geraldine's brother, Richard, who was with him at the time of the murders and could verify his story completely. In 1990, Ronald DeFeo Jr. filed a 440 motion, a proceeding to have his conviction vacated. In support of his motion, DeFeo asserted that Dawn and an unknown assailant who fled the house before he could get a good look at him killed their parents, and Dawn subsequently killed their siblings. He said the only person he killed was Dawn, and that it was by accident as they struggled over the rifle. Again, he asserted he was married to Geraldine and that her brother was with him at the time of the murders. An affidavit from Richard Romano was submitted to the court, and it was asserted he could not be located to testify in person. Evidence was submitted to the court by the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office, suggesting that Richard did not exist, and that Geraldine Gates was living in upstate New York, married to someone else at the time of the murders. Geraldine Gates did not testify at this hearing because the authorities had already confronted her about the false claims, and in 1992 secured a statement under oath where she admitted Romano was fictitious and that she did not accurately marry DeFeo until 1989 in anticipation of the filing of the 440 motion. Judge Stark denied the motion, writing, "I find the testimony of the defendant overall to be false and fabricated. His testimony that during the fall of 1974, he was married and lived with his wife and child at Long Branch, New Jersey, is incredible and not worthy of belief. He produced no corroborating evidence in this regard. Another reason for my disbelief of the defendant's testimony is demonstrated by consideration of several portions of the trial testimony. He signed a lengthy written statement describing in detail his activities. In this statement, he said that he lived with his family at 112 Ocean Avenue in Amityville and that he worked for his father, that he usually went to and from work with his father, that he was ill and stayed home from work on November 12, 1974, that he was on probation for having stolen an outboard engine and had an appointment to see his probation officer in Amityville on that very afternoon. Defendant's girlfriend, Mindy Weiss, testified that she began dating the defendant in June 1974 and was with him frequently that summer and fall. Stark further declared defendant's testimony that he did not shoot and kill the members of his family is likewise incredible and not worthy of belief. On November 30th, 2000, Ronald DeFeo met with Rick Onso, author of The Night the DeFeos Died, which he published in 2002. According to Onso, They spoke for about 6 hours. However, in a letter to the radio show host Lou Gentile, DeFeo Jr. denied giving Rika Unsua information that could be used in his book, claiming that he immediately left the interview and did not speak to Unsua about anything substantive. According to Unsua, DeFeo Jr. claimed that he had committed the murders with his sister Dawn and two friends, Augie DiGentero and Bobby Kelski, out of desperation, because his parents had plotted to kill him. Allegedly, Ronald claimed that after a furious row with his father, he and his sister planned to kill their parents so that Dawn murdered the children in order to eliminate them as witnesses. He said that he was enraged on discovering his sister's actions, knocked her unconscious onto her bed, and shot her in the head. Police found traces of unburned gunpowder on Dawn's nightgown, which DeFeo proponents allege proves she discharged a firearm. However, at trial, the ballistics experts testified that unburned gunpowder is discharged through the muzzle of a weapon, indicating that she was in proximity to the muzzle of the weapon when it was discharged and not that she fired the weapon. He reiterated this on an A&E Amityville documentary that is extensively discussed in Will Saviv's Mentally Ill in Amityville. Saviv had an expert evaluate Della Penna's assessment, and the expert confirmed that he was correct. Moreover, the medical examiner found nothing to indicate that Dawn had been in a struggle. The bullet wound was the only flesh mark on her body. Joe Nickel notes that given the frequency with which Ronald DeFeo had changed his story over the years, any new claims from him regarding the events that took place on the night of the murders should be approached with caution. Most of the claims made in Rick Unsua's book are sourced to Ronald DeFeo Jr.'s ex-wife, Geraldine Gates. While in the 1986 interview with Newsday, she asserted she married DeFeo in 1974, in Unsua's book, she alleges they married in 1970. Their 1993 divorce case says that they met in 1985, married in 89, and divorced in 1993. So when your story changes that much over the years, from this plot to that plot, what do you make of it?
Well, that's so hard to tell because there's so many different stories that you just shared.
Mm-hmm.
From this guy did it, no, this guy did it, no, my sister did them, I did my sister, there was a lot.
Yeah.
There was a lot. But to me, the sad thing is you can never know for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, and that's probably why there's so many stories going around, just to confuse people.
Yeah. I mean, there's no credibility there. Even if he did come out and say, you know, I did it because I was possessed, I mean, which was something that he did say early on, and then that was dismissed. And then it's like, well, that didn't work. Let's go to something else.
Which happens a lot.
Yeah.
Because anybody that's going to kill anybody is unstable.
Yeah.
But the one part that really bugged me in all those, that whole craziness of stories, was they killed the children so there wouldn't be any witnesses. Like, who would do that? If their kids were in bed,
yeah,
they weren't witnesses.
Well, and it didn't seem like a lot of the family was that much at odds. It seemed like the Ronald DeFeo was, but all the other accounts seemed like everybody was pretty, you know, okay with each other. Nowhere near the point of like, oh, fuck, you're a witness, I better kill you now, especially your siblings.
And the one sister that he blamed it on, like, what would her reason be?
Yeah.
For killing the whole family? Why? Because dad didn't let her go out or something? I mean, I didn't hear a reason for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's really...
But then what would his reason be for it?
And that's where...
he's batshit crazy or something.
And that could just simply be the answer, you know, that... that's why he did it. I think what makes it crazier is the ghosts. I'm not saying crazy as this is made up or anything, but what makes it just so, I guess, extreme is obviously the haunting story that we're about to get into, is everything that happened after. It makes you wonder, was there some sort of influence of paranormal on the night these murders happened? Because there's a lot of weird things with the murders. How did no one hear the gunshots? How are they all face down in the bed like that? And the bodies were not moved. And there's just so many things that don't make any sense that seem almost physically impossible for the murders to have occurred with only one person committing the act. That unless there was, there's two routes of thinking here. There was more than one murder, or there was something paranormal going on here that shielded everyone else from these sounds, or they were all deaf. I don't know. I don't know that's the biggest, weirdest part of the story is how did all these bodies end up like this?
Some of that for me is in 1970s, you know, their detection.
Yeah.
Their investigative tools aren't what they are today.
Sure.
And there could be something they would discover today. Why, like, maybe, I don't know. I'm just like thinking of all of the TV shows I watch.
Maybe there'd be more to uncover.
You know
what I mean?
There might be something that today there might be more of an answer for.
That would have been.
You know, there could be something that was in their bloodstream that they couldn't test. I mean, they didn't do DNA in the 70s.
Sure.
I mean, there could be something that they didn't detect. I don't know.
It could have been
a demon.
Yeah.
But it seems to me there would be another answer before demonic possession.
Yeah.
Because he's crazy. And, you know, kids can sleep really hard.
I don't know about that hard, but yeah, in some cases, you're probably right. It's just, it's weird. Let's continue on with the story. The Amityville Horror, the book purportedly based on a true story, describes the house at 112 Ocean Avenue as remaining empty for 13 months after the DeFeo murders. In December 1975, George and Kathleen Lutz bought the house for what would be considered to be the bargain price of $80,000. A five-bedroom house was built in Dutch colonial style and had a distinctive gambrel roof. It also had a swimming pool and a boathouse, as it was located on a canal. George and Kathy married in July 1975 and had their own homes, but they wanted to start fresh with a new property. Kathy had three children from a previous marriage, Daniel 9, Christopher 7, and Melissa 5. They also owned a crossbreed Malamute Labrador dog named Harry. During their first inspection of the house, the real estate broker told them about the DeFeo murders and asked if it would affect their decision. After discussing the matter, they decided it was not a problem. The Lutz family moved on December 19, 1975. Much of the DeFeo family's furniture was still in the house because it was included for a $400 price tag as part of the deal. A friend of George Lutz learned about the history of the house and insisted on having it blessed. At the time, George was a non-practicing Methodist and had no expertise of what this really would entail. Kathy was a non-practicing Catholic and explained the process. George knew a Catholic priest named Father Ray who agreed to carry out the house blessing. In Anston's book, Real Life Priest Father Ralph J. Pecorino is referred to as Father Mancusco for privacy reasons. Father Mancusco was a lawyer, judge of the Catholic court, and psychotherapist who lived at the local Sacred Heart Rectory. He arrived to perform the blessing while George and Kathy were unpacking their belongings on the afternoon of December 18, 1975, and went into the building to carry out the rites. When he flicked the first holy water and began to pray, he heard a masculine voice demand that he get out. When leaving the house, Father Mancusco did not mention this incident to either George or Kathy. On December 24th, 1975, Father called George Lutz and advised him to stay out of the second floor room where he had heard the mysterious voice, the former bedroom of Mark and John Matthew DeFeo, that Kathy planned to use as a sewing room. But the call was cut short by static. Following his visit to the house, Father Mancuso allegedly developed a high fever and blisters on his hands similar to stigmata. At first, George and Kathy experienced nothing unusual in the house. Talking about their experiences subsequently, they reported that it was as if they were each living in a different house. By mid-January 1976, after another attempt at house blessing by George and Kathy, they experienced what would turn out to be their final night in the house. The Lutzes declined to give a full account of the events that took place on this occasion, describing them as too frightening. After getting in touch with Father Mancuso, the Lutzes decided to take some belongings and stay at Kathy's mother's house in nearby Deer Park, New York, until they had sorted out the problems with the house. They claimed that the phenomena followed them there, with the final scene of Anston's book describing greenish-black slime coming from the staircase towards them. On January 14, 1976, George and Kathy Lutz with their three children and dog Harry left 112 Ocean Avenue, leaving all of their possessions behind. The next day, a mover arrived to remove the possessions to send to the Lutzes. He reported no paranormal phenomena while inside the house. The book was written after Tam Mossman, an editor at the publishing house Prentice Hall, introduced George and Kathy Lutz to Jay Anson. The Lutzes did not work directly with Anson, but submitted around 45 hours of tape-recorded recollections to him, which were used as the basis of the book. Estimates of the sales of the book were around 10 million copies from its numerous editions. Anson is said to have based the title of The Amityville Horror on The Dunwich Horror by H.P. Lovecraft, which was published in 1929. So, interesting to hear kind of the timeline of what went on, albeit brief, the Wikipedia entry, that some other areas, there's a lot more detail of what happened. Although he really, George, from what I remember, most of his life has never really gone into great detail about what happened that night that they decided they had to leave the house.
Well, here's what I don't get. Who are the people... Well, obviously, the Lutzes, that buy a house that an entire family was murdered in.
Yeah.
Like, that's a really good deal. Oh, and we get the furniture for $400. Great. Like, who would do that?
I guess it really just kind of depends on what your belief system
and the
is.
The pictures of the house look super cool. Like, I yeah. get, like, but don't, I don't know. It just seems to me you would walk in and it would just be a really creepy feeling knowing a child was murdered in that room and in that room and parents were murdered in that room. Like, I just don't get that.
And even if you don't believe
so
in ghosts,
yeah, they had to leave in the middle of the night. Some shit was going down.
Even if you don't believe that that would be a ghostly thing, just the idea of those things happening in your house, I couldn't do that. Even if it was
like,
a
we
good
did
deal.
An episode a couple weeks ago about BTK.
Yeah.
And no one was even killed in that house. Mm-hmm. And they demolished the house.
Sure.
But there are people who live in one of the, right up the street where the family was murdered. And I guess that's, like, does anybody live in that house now? Or
yeah.
Is it still around?
It is around. It's around. The address has changed. The windows are no longer those creepy eye windows. But no, the house is still around to this day. And
I take those windows out too.
I believe it typically sells for around $1 million when it's on the market. They've had issues when they put it on the market of people wanting just to show up and walk around the house and see it and whatnot. And it was on the market not that long ago. It is still there.
I can't imagine, like, moving into that house with kids, even. Mm-hmm. My kids were murdered in this house. I'm going to move my family in.
Publicly,
no one
has said anything about the house having anything in it since this story. Publicly has said anything about anything.
Yeah, but what have you heard off the record?
Publicly, no one has said anything about anything happening with the house. Let's
you
move on.
I know you have.
Let's move on to the next chapter in our story. The role of Father Pecoraro in this story has been given considerable attention. During the course of the lawsuit surrounding the case in the late 1970s, Father Pecoraro stated in an affidavit that his only contact with the Lutzes concerning the matter had been by telephone. Other accounts say that Father Pecoraro did visit the house but experienced nothing unusual there. Father Pecoraro gave what may have been his only on-camera interview about his recollections during a 1980 episode of In Search Of, a documentary series hosted by Leonard Nimoy. Father Pecoraro's face was obscured during the interview to preserve his anonymity. In the interview, he repeated the claim that he heard a voice saying, "Get out," but stopped short of giving it a paranormal origin. He also stated that he felt a slap on his face during the visit and that he did subsequently experience blistering on his hands. The claims of physical damage to the locks, doors, and windows were rejected by Jim and Barbara Cometry, who bought the house for $55,000 in March of 1977. In a television interview filmed at the house for That's Incredible, Barbara argued that they appeared to be the original items and had not been repaired. The That's Incredible feature also showed the Red Room was a small closet in the basement that would have been known to the previous owners of the house, the Lutzes, because it was not concealed in any way. The claim made in Chapter 11 of the book was that the house was built on the site where the local Shinnecock Indians had once abandoned the mentally ill and the dying was rejected by local Native American leaders. The claim of cloven hoof prints on the snow on January 1, 1976 was rejected by other researchers because weather records show that there had been no snow in Amityville on that date. Neighbors reported nothing unusual during that time, that the Lutzes were living there. Police officers are dispatched visiting the houses in the book and in the 1979 film, but records show that the Lutzes did not call the police during the period that they were living on Ocean Avenue. There was no bar in Amityville called the Witch's Brew at the time. Ronald DeFeo Jr. was a regular customer at Henry's Bar, a short distance from 112 Ocean Avenue. Critics, including Stephen Kaplan, have pointed out that changes were made to the book as it was reprinted in different editions. In the original hardcover edition, Father Pecoraro's car is an old tan Ford, and he experiences an incident in which the hood flies up against the windshield while he's driving it. In later editions, the car is described as a Chevrolet Vega, before reverting back to a Ford. In May 1977, George and Kathy Lutz filed a lawsuit against William Weber, the defense lawyer for Ronald DeFeo Jr. at his trial. Paul Hoffman, a writer working on an account of the hauntings, Bernard Burton and Frederick Mars both alleged clairvoyants who had examined the house, along with Good Housekeeping magazine, the New York Sunday News, and the Hearst Corporation, all of which had published articles related to the hauntings. The Lutzes alleged misappropriation of names for trade purposes, invasion of privacy, and mental distress. They claimed $4.5 million in damages. Hoffman, Weber, and Burton immediately filed a countersuit for $2 million alleging fraud and breach of contract. The claims against the news corporations were dropped for lack of evidence, and the remainder of the lawsuit was heard by Brooklyn U.S. District Court Judge Jack B. Weinstein. In September 1979, Judge Weinstein dismissed the Lutz's claims, observing in his ruling, "Based on what I've heard, it appears to me that the large extent of the book is a work of fiction," relying in large part upon the suggestion of Mr. Weber. In the September 17, 1979 issue of People magazine, William Weber wrote, "I know this book is a hoax. We created this horror story over many bottles of wine." This refers to a meeting that the Webers is said to have had with George and Kathy Lutz, during which they discussed what would later become the outline of Anson's book. Judge Weinstein also expressed concern about the conduct of William Weber and Bernard Burton relating to the affair, stating, "There's a very serious ethical question when lawyers become literary agents." George Lutz maintained that events in the book were mostly true and denied any suggestion of dishonesty on his part. In June of 1979, George and Kathy Lutz took a polygraph test relating to their experiences at the house. The polygraph tests were performed by Chris Gugis and Michael Rice, who at the time were reportedly among the top five polygraph experts in America. The results, in Mr. Rice's opinion, did not indicate lying. In October of 2000, the History Channel broadcast Amityville, The Haunting and Amityville Horror or Hoax, a two-part documentary made by horror screenwriter-producer Daniel Ferens. George Lutz commented in the interview for the program, "I believe this has stayed alive for 25 years because it's a true story." It doesn't mean that everything that's ever been said about it is true. It's certainly not a hoax. It's real easy to call something a hoax. I wish it was. It's not. The debate about the accuracy of the Amityville Horror continues, and despite the lack of evidence to corroborate much of the story, it remains one of the most popular haunting accounts in American folklore. The various owners of the house since the Lutz family left in 1976 have reported no problems while living there. James Cromarty, who bought the house in 1977 and lived there with his wife Barbara for 10 years, commented, "Nothing weird ever happened except for people coming by because of the book and the movie." Kathleen Teresa Lutz died of emphysema, and George Lee Lutz died of heart disease in 2006. The couple had divorced in the late 1980s, but remained on good terms. During the period in which the Lutz family was living at 112 Ocean Avenue, Dr. Stephen Kaplan, a self-styled vampirologist and ghost hunter, were called in to investigate the house. Kaplan and the Lutzes had a falling out after Kaplan said that he would expose any fraud that was found. Kaplan went on to write a critical book titled The Amityville Horror Conspiracy with his wife Roxanne Kaplan. The book was published in 1995. On the night of March 6, 1976, the house was investigated by Ed and Lorraine Warren, a husband and wife team of self-described demonologists, together with a crew from the television Channel 5, New York, and reporter Michael Linder of WNEW-FM. During the course of the investigation, Gene Campbell took a series of infrared time-lapse photographs. One of the images allegedly showed a demonic boy with glowing eyes who was standing at the foot of a staircase. The photograph did not emerge into the public domain until 1979, when George and Kathy Lutz and Rod Steiger appeared on the Merv Griffin Show to promote the release of the first film. 112 Ocean Avenue was also investigated by parapsychologist Hans Holzer. The Warrens and Holzer have suggested that the house is occupied by malevolent spirits due to its history. The Warrens' visit to the house was depicted in the 2016 film The Conjuring 2. George Lutz registered the phrase the Amityville Horror as a trademark in 2002 and is referred to as the Amityville Horror TM on his official website. Lutz claimed that the film producers embellished or fabricated events portrayed in the 1979 version and the 2005 remake. He also claimed that the producers of the 2005 film did not involve his family and that they used his name without permission. 112 Ocean Avenue in December 2005. The house is known as 112 Ocean Avenue. It still exists, but it's been renovated and the address changed in order to discourage sightseers from visiting it. The famous quarter-round windows have been removed, and the house today looks considerably different from its depiction in the films. The house in Toms River, used as a location for the first three films, has also been modified for the same reason. For the 2005 film version, the house was renamed 412 Ocean Avenue. In the 2005 film remake, it says the basement of the Lutz's home was built in 1692, but 112 Ocean Avenue, also known as High Hopes, was built around 1924 for John and Catherine Moynihan. The local residents and authorities in Amityville, New York, are unhappy with the attention that the Amityville Horror brings to the town and tend to decline requests to discuss it publicly. The website of the Amityville Historical Society makes no mention of the murders by Ronald DeFeo Jr. in 1974 or the period that the Lutz family lived at 112 Ocean Avenue. When the History Channel made its documentary about the Amityville Horror in 2000, no member of the Historical Society would discuss the matter on camera. The episode of CSI New York, first broadcast on October 31st, 2007, was a Halloween edition based on the Amityville Horror, entitled Boo. It featured a house in Amityville where a family has died in circumstances similar to the DeFeo murders. In May 2010, the house was placed on the market with an asking price of $1.15 million. In August 2010, the house was sold to a local resident for $950,000. On August 21st, 2010, the departing owner held a moving sale at the house and hundreds of people turned up for the event. They were allowed to go inside the house, but not to visit the upstairs rooms or the basement. So would you have shown up for the moving sale just out of morbid curiosity?
Well, I'm one of those people who would kind of deep down like to.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't do it for that reason.
Oh, you say that.
No, like, because, like, I'd kind of like a tour of the house, but I don't want to do it at the same time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
So I don't know which side of me would win out, but I would really like to go into the house, and this weird part of me wants to do that.
Would you not want to go into the house because you'd be afraid of what you might feel, or would you not want to go into the house because you don't want to be a gawker?
I don't want to be a gawker.
Okay.
But I wouldn't want to be in the house at night by myself. Oh, hell no.
Sure.
Like, no. And, you know, it's always been one of those stories that really intrigued me from when I was a kid. Because I remember, like, a zillion years ago reading the book.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always felt like, you know, because you and I do the ghost stories. We talk ghost stories all the time.
Yeah.
A lot of the movies and books and things like that, they just go that step too far to where it isn't really believable, you know, the goo coming down the stairs and stuff like that.
Sure.
And that's kind of what I felt. And so I really, really have always believed that there's a murder that happened in that house. I can fully believe there's some weird shit that happened, because it wasn't just one murder. It was a whole family. And I really believe that would still be in the house, that energy, you know, that was horrific. But I do believe that it was blown up. Mm-hmm. Like I know something happened. I know that. Now, is it what you see in the movie? Probably not, because it wouldn't be as good as of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Or the book wouldn't be as fascinating. It probably wouldn't have taken off the way it did.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that sometimes you have to have a little bit of license with that if you're wanting to mass market a book.
Sure.
Or a movie.
Sure.
But I definitely think something happened.
I do,
and
too.
I can't imagine living in that house to this day. And it's like nothing. Well, family got murdered here. Nothing.
Christopher Quarantino, who's his name now, he was one of the children, and he does speaking on this to a certain degree, but there's a whole part of the story that I believe he has not shared yet. He always teases it, and it's kind of one of those things, like, when I'm ready to talk about it, I'll talk about it, and I do respect that, because, you know, this is a trauma.
They left in the middle of the night. Yeah. Something happened.
I really
do believe they left in the middle of the night.
Like, yeah. And you know, he was a kid at the time, so the way that, you know, you process it is going to be different than how the adults processed it. I would just love at some point for him to be able to share that story. And you know, it's for the interest reasons, you know, that, of course, everyone has in it. But at the same point, and this is different for everybody, but I think many of us, if you had an experience, being able just to get it out there is extremely therapeutic. Now, if that's the case for him, I don't know. I'm not him. But yes. I don't know that holding something like that in is going to be, you know, the best thing mental health-wise. I don't know if that's the best thing for anybody. But again, that's a personal question that he has to really answer. But he'd be one of the, him or any of the other siblings, to reveal something.
You know, wouldn't it be ironic if because we assume, like, he's really got a story to tell. Maybe his story is that, nothing happened.
Well,
like, my parents made that whole thing up.
There's another documentary that's out, and I interviewed the filmmaker on that. And this one came out about 2013, 2014, I don't know, somewhere around there. It's called My Amityville Horror. It's another good one to binge watch if you're looking for something to binge right now. And the other brother is interviewed in that, and you can be the judge of how he comes across, but he has a whole other level to the story that involves George. It involves George practicing different things that he believes George brought this upon the house. And it goes back to being George's fault to a certain extent. It's my interpretation anyway, from the movie. It's probably the closest that we've gotten so far to a super detailed, very dramatic interview from one of the living people that that have lived through that house. Highly worth watching. If you're looking for a good, creepy thing to watch right now, find that one and stream it, called My Amityville Horror. And we also, I've done an interview with, like I said, the filmmaker on that, and that you can listen to on Real Ghost Stories Online. That's our other podcast. And that's way back in the archive, way back to one of the first episodes that we've ever done. But that was another fascinating conversation about this case that I don't know, you know, just when you think it's going to end, just when you think there's nothing else to tell or hear or say about this case other than just opinions, it's funny because around every 10, 15 years or so, there's some other chapter or piece that seems to come to the surface that makes you go,
Do you think, or could it be somebody figured out a way to get some more attention and possibly make a little bit of money?
You know,
could that be too?
That could be too. I mean, there's always that as a possibility. You just, I don't know. I mean, yes, is that a possibility? It certainly is. But nonetheless, there's always pieces to the story that are surfacing every so often that were not out of the ether before.
And I do think that house is haunted. Yeah. I really do. I do.
I do too. And I think it's one that will always remain quite a mystery. That's going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like our program, be sure to press that subscribe button wherever you are listening to us and let your friends know that we exist. Share us on social media. We greatly appreciate that support. Until next time, for The Dark Side of Wikipedia and for Carol, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.